We live in a world there where we find this, and I am just as prone as anyone. When we were on our trip a month or so ago, we were flying from New York to Istanbul, Turkey, on this Airbus 330, and it had this screen on the back of the seat in front of us. And one of the things it had 3D GPS. So in other words, you could see a little picture of your plane, and you could see what you're, oh, we're flying over Iceland, isn't that cool? And you could look at the plane from the left, the right, from below, above. And then we took a Boeing aircraft from Istanbul to Tel Aviv, and it only had 1D GPS. You just looked down flat. And I remember thinking, this is a real disappointment that I can only watch. And I realized, I'm flying through the air at 35,000 feet, okay? There's a certain magic to that when you think about it, when you just to imagine you're there. And I'm traveling 7,000 miles in just a few hours. I don't have to worry about my ship hitting an iceberg and sinking. I know this is, and I'm worried about that I don't have 3D GPS on the seat back in front of me. I'm just like, okay, I can be as guilty as these people. So we want to talk tonight about finding true contentment. Finding true contentment, that's our subject for the night. And I want to go to a passage. We'll get to Philippians 4 here in just a moment. But I want to go to a first passage, and this is going to sound a little strange. I do not want you to turn to this passage, okay? Because I just want you to listen. Because the person that we pick out, and you've already figured out who it is, that we're going to have our teacher tonight from the Word of God about contentment, probably would be, if you just, the passage I'm about to read you would think he would be the least likely candidate to find contentment. So here's what I want you to do, okay? I want you to list in your mind, if you're really good, you can count them, okay? Some of you are like, numbers are your thing, and you'll be able to, some of you will be equipped with a number, but a list of things that he's going to give here in just a moment that you would suppose would take away your contentment, okay? This is from 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more, and here's the list, in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths often. From the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I've spent in the deep, in journeys often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness, besides the other things, what comes upon me daily, the deep concern for all the churches. Now, the Apostle Paul is there in defending these people that were accusing him of being a false apostle. He says, here's my credentials. Did anyone come up with a number? A lot. What'd you get? 27. Anyone else got a different number? Then what's that? Then 27 it is. Okay, very good. I actually didn't bother to count because I knew we had people like you in the mix. But you look at that list of all these things that he endured, and you have to remember, Paul started out having a pretty cushy environment. Remember, he talks about he was a Pharisee of the Pharisees, of the tribe of Benjamin. He also says that he studied at the feet of Gamaliel, who was one of the chief rabbis of the day. You didn't get to be Gamaliel's disciple unless you had some connections. You had some family connections. He probably didn't have to worry about getting a scholarship to pay for his schooling, if we'd say it that way. I mean, he had an upbringing, he had a position, he had prestige, and he just considered it all just trash, if you will, for the cause of Christ. And then he experienced all of these things. You think about just one that where he talks about, he said more than once he received 40 stripes less one. There's 39 stripes with a leather strap across the bare back. Can you imagine? And to be beaten with rods and to be stoned. And you remember he was left for dead when he was stoned. They thought, surely he's dead. It was only through the grace of God. That doesn't even tell us about some of the other stories. Remember the snake bite? You remember being led over the wall in a basket from Damascus? I mean, there's more even than this list. But Paul tells us here, if you want to make your way to Philippians 4, in this this wonderful little package of verses, he tells us about his status of contentment. Let me just read verses 10 through 13 for you from Philippians 4. It says, "But I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now, at last, your care for me has flourished again, though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." We like that last verse I just read, don't we? Most of us have memorized it. Maybe you have it on a plaque somewhere. You have that. Maybe you have that underlined or highlighted in your Bible. But it is connected with this context of contentment and where it comes from. And that's what I just want to share. That's what I want to remind myself of tonight, and you can listen in, okay? Number one, I'm just going to divide this into real two simple sections. Number one, what contentment is not, and then we'll talk about what contentment is from this passage. What contentment is not, okay? It is not, first of all, what we've already alluded to and what we've already thought about with that list from 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and what we have already talked about in the introduction. So what it is not. Number one, contentment is not the absence of struggles. Now, we're here on a nice spring evening. I don't know about you, but the weather out there, it's sunny, but it's cool and it's dry and it's just sort of almost, in my mind, just about as perfect as you could get for a spring evening. And you might think, oh, well, of course you're going to feel content there. But how long is that weather going to last? I did not check the weather forecast. But it is destined to change at some point, probably sooner rather than later. You see, the circumstances that we have change pretty much as often as the weather do, or more often. So we don't always have a day like this. I also know that we're now right on the brink of, you know, we're into May. It's almost school's out time. School will be out before the month is over. And then it's vacation time. And some of us think, you know, well, if I could just make it to vacation, pack up the minivan and head to the beach for a week or two, all is well. And I know some of you are beach people, and that's fine if you are. But you understand you only stay there a certain amount of time, and then you got to pack up the minivan and head for home, right? And maybe, I don't know if you've had this experience, sometimes even the vacations themselves are not as stress-free as we might hope them to be. But anyway, it is not the absence of struggles. And he says that in the text. Now, in the context, he says, "I rejoice," verse 10, "greatly, in the Lord greatly, that now at last your care for me has flourished." Apparently, this is really the cause for the writing of this wonderful letter of Philippians. It's a blessing that this happened because it puts this before us. This basically is an extended thank you note for the gift that the Philippians sent to support Paul in his ministry. And he says, you flourished again, though you did surely care, but you lacked opportunity. In other words, you helped me before. There's been a law or a gap for whatever reason, we don't know. But then another gift has come to sustain him in ministry, a monetary gift, obviously. So he sits down to write this thank you note. And under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, we have all this treasure that we call the letter to the Philippians. So, but then he sets this up interestingly. "Not that I speak in regard to want," verse 11. He makes it clear that the reason he's rejoicing is not because he received a gift, although he is thankful for it. He is thankful for what this says about them in their spiritual maturity, that they are investing in God's work. So he's more excited about that. And to make this point clear, he goes into this little section, if you will, about contentment. And he says, "Not that I speak regard to need, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am to be content." In whatsoever state I am. And now we'll see some of that in just a moment, and because we're going to kind of go over this twice. But contentment is not the absence of struggles. Why is that? Well, you understand that we live in a sinful world filled with sinful people, and we are one ourselves, okay? We are sinful people ourselves. There is going to be things wrong. This is not a perfect world. And on top of that, God, and this is recorded for us in the third chapter, only three chapters into the story of the Bible, God tells us because of Adam and Eve's sin, He cursed this world and made it much more difficult for us to do many things. And all the trouble and the toil and the trauma that we have in our world today is a result of that. So throughout history, there have been people who just thought, if we could just get away from the world, we'll find contentment. That's the reason there were monasteries established usually in isolated places, way off from everybody. If we can get away from all the people and all the worldly influences, we'll be content. How well do you think that worked? Not very well, because you can't get away from even yourself and your sinful self. So contentment is not the absence of struggles. And sometimes we just think, if I could just get away from everything, if I could just be alone or whatever, it's not going to work. Number two, probably more importantly, contentment is not dependent upon circumstances to be just right. Now, part of the problem is us and what we have been taught, and maybe what we have taught our own children. And if you've told this story to your children, I don't want you to feel too guilty, but maybe you can find something else to tell your children and grandchildren. But how do we frame in our literature and in our stories we tell, how do we frame things becoming good? Do you remember a story of this poor little girl, and she had a really mean stepmother, and she had two really mean stepsisters? And they were so mean that when the handsome prince was going to throw this fancy ball at the castle and invite all of the eligible ladies, because he was looking for a wife, all the eligible ladies to come to the ball so that he could, I guess, just, you know, like picking clothes off a rack, I guess, to pick the one that he was going to fall in love with. And you remember Cinderella didn't have a dress to wear. She didn't have a ride to the fancy ball. So what happens in this story? Well, off goes the stepsister, and off goes the stepsisters and the stepmother, and the way they go, and Cinderella's just left to sweep the coal dust up in the house or whatever, and suddenly, who appears? Ah, you did tell this story to your children, didn't you? Or you saw the Disney version on the film. But suddenly, her fairy godmother comes, and what does she do? She changes all of her circumstances. Bing, you have a fancy ball gown. Bing, you have glass slippers. I don't think they're very practical, but that's what she gives her, glass slippers. And then we have some mice and a pumpkin. Bing, bing. She turns them into a carriage and into horses. And, of course, it's all going to expire at midnight. You'd think somebody that could bing mice into horses would have a little bit of a longer time frame than midnight, but that's how the story goes. And off she goes. The prince falls in love with her. She manages to drop one of her slippers on the way out, and finally the prince finds her. I'm condensing this for time's sake. The prince finds her. The slipper fits her foot, and how does the story end? They all did what? They all... Why? Because Cinderella's circumstances changed. There's a reason they call them fairy tales, because that's not how life really works. But we have, and we say, well, I know that's fantasy, and I get that. But the fairy tale syndrome is part of what Satan wants to convince us of. That if suddenly just things could magically change, if suddenly someone could show up with a magic wand and go bing, 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 everything would be well. You know, we'll have a whole list of things that we would change. We have a whole list of things most of us, if we were honest, we'd change about ourselves. If you had the magic wand, what would you change about yourself? I'd make myself a little taller. I'd make myself a little thinner. I'd change the shape of my nose. I would take the gray out of my hair, or maybe put hair back where it used to be. Or I would do all these. And you know what you would create if you had the power to do it? You'd create someone that's not you. But in reality, God made you the way He wanted you to be. And we need to be content with that. It is not the dependent upon circumstances. Our children try the fairy tale syndrome with us as well. If only you would let me go to the whatever the thing is that all the other kids are going to. If I can only have that toy, or the big one. If you would let me have a puppy, I would take care of it. I would feed it. I would walk it. I would clean up after it. Have you heard this story somewhere in life? And you know what happens about 3 weeks later? You know who's caring for the puppy and cleaning up after it, and you know how that goes, right? If you could just change my circumstances, Mom and Dad, I would love you forever and everything would be well. I would be content forever. How long does it last? It doesn't. It is not dependent upon circumstances. He says in this state, in whatsoever state I am. He said, I've learned no matter whether the circumstances are good or bad that I can trust in it. So, very simply, let's just say it this way. I'm going to give you a couple of things that we just need to commit to and we need to be involved in. Number one, stop looking for the perfect life. It's going to be difficult because the world tells us if we would just buy their product, you would have the perfect life. If you would ask your doctor about this product, it will regrow hair on your head, you will have the perfect life. If you will buy this particular brand new automobile, you will have the perfect life. If you can go to this vacation, you know, and you'll just have this romantic time with your husband or your wife, and it'll be wonderful. Or you can go to Las Vegas, and what happens stays in Las Vegas, you know. That's good. What mainly stays in Las Vegas is all your money. That's what's going to stay there. And let's not even talk about your, you know, what could happen to your reputation depending on what you're bought. Like, you could go to Las Vegas and be righteous about it, but that's not what they're selling in the commercial. Let's put it that way. That's not what they're selling. So we have all this pressure. If you do these things or you don't do these things, you can have the perfect life. And we just need to say, that's not what we should be looking for, because you are never going to find it in this world. Contentment is not dependent on things. I found this quote by Ben Franklin, of all people. And this is what he said. Contentment makes poor men rich, and discontent makes rich men poor. You know, we just think, if I had more money, if I had more of whatever, then everything's going to be well. No, it's not measured in what we have. It's how we measure what we have as a gift from God that makes all the difference in the world. So stop looking for the perfect life. And you've heard me say this before, so this is not a first run for what I'm about to say. But one of the keys to contentment is simply this, is just lower your expectations a little bit. We shouldn't expect things to last forever and run problem-free and all is well. That's just not feasible. So let's get to what contentment is. That's really where I want to spend the bulk of our thoughts tonight. What contentment is, okay? Back to our text, verse 11. Not that I speak in respect to need. He says, I'm not thanking you just because this meets a need. I'm thanking you for higher purposes. He says, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. Number one, contentment is a learned response to life. That's what Paul says. It can be learned. It's an interesting, you have to understand that in the Greek language, there are nuances of the words, many different nuances that you don't get in English. For instance, there's, you know, we just have a verb that is, you know, stands there, but verbs have different connotations to them in Greek, and it's because of the endings that are on them. The construction here of this, where he says have learned, and I will spare you the long definition unless you just really want it. It's a constantive second aorist active indicative verbal form. Does that help you any? It simply means this. It means I have come to learn. I used to not know this, but I have, in the process of time, I've come to learn this. He had not always known it, but now he does. That's a way of saying it. How did he learn it? Probably through shipwrecks and through beatings and stonings and hunger and thirst and in peril. He said, I have learned in whatsoever state I am to be content. Now, for most of us who struggle, and let me just rephrase that, for all of us who at times no doubt struggle with contentment, I want to relieve you with a little bit. I want to alleviate a little bit of your burden and a little bit of your guilt, because he says, "I have learned this." It's a learned response to life. Most of us just have to say, we talked about this morning. We're still in school. We have not come to graduation yet. We have a few more classes to get in. We have a few more credits to earn, and it's called life. So the fact that we still struggle with this subject of contentment is not a reason to say, well, give up, it's pointless. No. This is something that can be learned, and we're still in school. But the fact that it is learned means that there is hope that it can be acquired. And maybe it isn't immediately acquired for every moment of our life, but maybe it's acquired for stretches of our life. And maybe as we mature, the stretches of our life stretch out a little bit. And we can just have more of our life filled with contentment rather than discontentment. It is a learned response to life. It is never separated from the experiences God puts us through. There's a thing in the back of my wife's Bible. For years, my wife would write down little sayings in the back of her Bible. And occasionally, I will go there and I'll go through the list. And this is actually what the second Bible those things have appeared in. I think you copied them over from an old Bible that was falling apart. But one of them, it's a quote by Theodore Epp. Some of you remember Theodore Epp on the Back to the Bible, yes. But his statement was this, simply this: all sunshine makes a desert. You think about that for a moment. We all want sunshine. I wish it would never rain. You don't have any rain, you got a desert. You got to have the rain to balance out things, to make things grow. And we just have to realize that when the rain falls, when the clouds come into our lives, the storms come, they are sent there to be part of God's school and God's curriculum, God's textbook, if you will, to teach us to be content. Secondly, contentment is an acceptance of life's changes. He makes this phrase, he says, I've learned to be content. And by the way, contentment is just simply just being okay with whatever the situation is. It is that which is this. And let me give you this definition that may help. It is the ability to rejoice regardless of physical or otherwise circumstances of life. It is not a natural gift. It is that which we gain through our experience, okay? So it is an acceptance of life changes. Look at the next verse. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. There will be some of both in our lives. Abased really means to be humbled, brought low. To abound means to reach the point of just overflowing. They are absolute polar opposites in their extremity. And he says, here's what I've learned. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere, in all things, I have learned, there's that phrase again, both to full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. That's a lot of spectrum of change. I know how to be content with nothing. I know how to be content with a whole bunch. Frankly, in our society, we probably have more content with having too much. It probably spoils our contentment as much as being in want in our world today. But it's that changeableness of life. Life does have its ups and downs. Now, when you think about that extremity of that, we need to accept that in all of this, that we look at it a certain way, that we look at even the low points were times where God teaches us, and the high points are times of God's blessing. As you get a little bit older, as I have this kind of perspective now in life, you can look back over life. And sometimes we do this with our station life, our career, our economic situation, and that sort of thing. Julie and I were, I think I was talking, but we had this conversation a while back. It's actually when our kids were still at home. And you know how it is when you got kids at home. I mean, they, you know, it's this ball game and this event and this school project, and it's just, you know, just like there's no time to yourself. And I remember saying to her, you know, in that brief window after we got married but before kids came along, we were just, you know, we didn't have all these responsibilities. Why didn't we travel and do things? And we sat around like, oh, I know why. Because we didn't have enough money to buy a tank of gas to get out of town. That's why. You know, and it kind of takes you back to those lean days, those early marriage days when we were living, you know, it wasn't a lot of extra. So sometimes we look back of where we've come from, but I want to challenge you to do that in the spiritual realm, not just the economic or just what home I live in or, you know, what's my situation in life. But where have you come from spiritually? How to be abased and how to abound. If you go back to your pre-salvation days, that's about as abased as you could be. That's about as low as you go. Lost is about as low as you can go. It is as low as you can go spiritually. And you think about where you've come from. You want a really scary thought to think about? You want to really just really give yourself a really scary time? Think about or imagine where you might be today if you weren't saved when you were saved? Where might you have wound up in life? Some of us may not still be here. We might have been so destructive in our lives we would have run the car off into a tree or done something else destructive. You want to get it real scary? Where could you be tonight? You might be lost in eternity in hell, except for that moment. That's as low as you can go. Or where would you be in life? Where would you be in all those sorts of things? We have enough damage and regret even being saved, but where would you be? But where are you now? Well, not everything's perfect in life, but where are you now spiritually? Jesus said it this way, you are secure in me, and I give unto them eternal life, he says in John 10, and they shall never perish, that's his sheep, and no one will pluck them out of my hand. I've got them, and I've got a grip on them, and I'm not going to let them go. That's where we are. Be abased and abound, that's the extremity of it. It's the acceptance of life changes, but part of those life changes is what God is doing. And yes, there are ups and downs and all of that. I want to just encourage you, in those difficult moments in life, if you can, find some humor in it. Find some humor in it. I remember one time when we lived in Clarksburg, we were actually down this way. We were heading up Interstate 79 and just driving along. It was a nice day, and I had my favorite, music playing in the stereo, just driving along, happy as could be, and all of a sudden, whoo, 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 pull over to the side of the road, call a tow truck, the whole rest of it. And I remember telling a friend of mine, I said, I'm complaining, and then we had to call a tow truck and pay for that and get the thing fixed, and how are we going to get home? And I said, I was just driving along, everything's fine. Did you just drive along, taking it easy? And God interrupted your plans, didn't he? I thought, yes, he did. And by inference, he was saying, don't get too satisfied that everything's well. Don't get too big for your own, understanding and that sort of thing. So find humor in it. Also find purpose in it. We talked about that this morning, and I don't want to preach this morning's message again, but it sort of fits together. If we can learn the discipline, if I can learn the discipline of just coming to the point of saying, this experience of life, this stage of life, Lord, what do you want me to learn now? What is today's lesson? What is the current thing you're working on? And maybe we need to ask each other this question on occasion. Just, what's God teaching you in current days? What are you learning in this stage of life? What are you learning with a set of goods and bads, of pluses and minuses, of credits and debits that he has programmed into the ledger of your life? What's he teaching you? Because he's teaching you. So find humor in it, find purpose in it, find the lesson in it. Okay, what's the takeaway? What's the summary from that? What's the one thing I want to hold on to from that experience that I don't want to let go of? And just understand that God he does have a purpose and he does have a lesson to take away. Several years ago, going through a really, an unpleasant experience of life, I have a friend of mine who is sort of a mentor and just a wise person in my life. And I was talking to my friend Joe on the phone and just kind of singing the blues over the phone without, actually putting tune to it. And he said to me simply, he says, Jess, God loves you too much to waste this experience in your life. I got to tell you, I didn't really enjoy hearing that at the moment. It's like, no, that's not what I wanted to hear. I wanted you to just let me sob a little while longer. But even those difficult experiences in life, God can use them to have a takeaway that we can continue to go forward, all right? Back to our text. Not that I speak in regard to want, verse 10, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, I know how to abound. Everywhere in all things, I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. In other words, I can just be satisfied no matter the circumstances. And sometimes contentment and joy are somehow replaced and eclipsed by our concept of happiness. We talked a little bit about that this morning. Well, the point of life is not that we be happy all the time. Oh, I need to be happy. This will make me happy. That doesn't make me happy. I'm going to do things that make me happy. Well, there are higher points than just making me happy. It's being obedient, honoring God, doing things the right way, doing the right thing. We understand that. So it is more than that. But then come down to verse 13. Here's where the ultimate sense, I think, of contentment comes from. When we can get a hold of this and we don't let go. when we really don't let go of this. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I want to start at the end of that verse and work my way back to the front if I can. How much strength does Jesus have? You don't even have to say it. You know it, right? He has unlimited, almighty ability and power. I can do all things through this unlimited reservoir of power that it comes through the benevolent, loving hand of Jesus Christ. And you know he loves you because he died. He gave his life for you and for me. It says in 1 Corinthians that through his death he reconciled the whole world to himself. That this expansive gift of love was put out there. And we know that we are loved in that regard. So let's move our way back. We can do all things through Christ who strengthened me. Through Christ. Well, where is the Lord Jesus? Some of the last words he said before his ascension, he said, "Lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age." It's not recorded in the Gospels, which is interesting enough, but it's very near the end of Hebrews, where the writer of Hebrews, who is unnamed to us, but the writer of Hebrews quotes Jesus. And he quotes Jesus as saying, "For he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you." I can do all things, even find contentment in the ratty, nasty, gnarly, prickly points of life, because I can do it through Christ who is right here with me. And the one who's right here with me is a God of infinite strength. See, contentment is simply this: depending on his control in our life, depending on God's control in our life. And then move it back, okay? I can do all things. Well, what are the all things? It's the list he just gave. I can be hungry. I can be full. I can abound. I can suffer need. I can be abased. I can abound in whatsoever state I am. In all of those circumstances, I can do those things. I can endure those things. And not only endure those things just like I survived, but I can really enjoy those things. All things through Christ. Don't ever look at the contentment apart from verse 13. And don't ever look at verse 13 apart from commitment that precedes it. It is plugged into this context and it all fits together in a package. Sometimes we catch ourselves asking the big why question. And this is not first run for this, what I'm about to share with you either. But it'd be a good point to give some repetition to it. You know, we ask the why question too often. Why this? Why now? Why me? Why us? And God in his mercy, sometimes he will let us live long enough and he gives us enough grace to answer that question. Okay, now we at least see the why. I'm convinced that it's never a single why with what God does. What God does has multiple reasons and interrelations. I mean, it's a thing way beyond what we can get down to one thing. But sometimes he lets us figure out one or two things. But sometimes God never answers the why question. Why did this happen? I don't know. I've had people come to me, I guess because I'm a pastor, and say, "Pastor, why did this happen?" And I just have to say, I don't have any more answer to that question than you do. I can't find a chapter and verse on it. You know, there's some big picture things like why did bad happen? Why is there tragedy? Well, some of it relates to the curse and the effects of sin. But why in particular this point, this person, this way, this thing? I can't give it to you. But when you can't answer the why question, you change the question. And you don't ask why, you ask who. And the who is simply in this verse, through Christ who strengthens me. We may not know the why, but we know the who, and who will get us through and who will see us through. Commitment number two. Start looking for God's involvement in your life. And maybe I should rephrase that because I think you do and I think we try. But let's continue to look for God's involvement in your life. That we take an inventory of the things that we could praise the Lord for. My insurance agent, or the company, sent this thing to us and said, you know, one of the things you should do is take an inventory of the stuff in your house. So if your house ever burns down, blows up, or falls over, whatever, and you have to get reimbursed for all the stuff in your house. You got to tell them what you lost. You know, and one of the things they suggested was go all around through your house with a camera and take pictures. Open every drawer, take a picture. Open every closet, take a picture. That was scary at times. And go in your attic. That was really scary. And in your garage and your store, and take a picture and then store that. I don't know if he knows this or not, but that's stored over at my dad's house right now on an external hard drive that I gave him. Hope you know where it is, Dad. I hope I don't need you to know, because I hope I don't need it. But I was just taking pictures, and I'm just thinking, I have a lot of stuff. I need to probably downsize some of the stuff I have. I'm not a hoarder, but I can certainly appreciate them from my point of view, some of the things I keep when I shouldn't. But, you know, you take an inventory of stuff. You know, sometimes we need to get out our mental camera and just go around our lives and think about all of the blessings and all of the items of praise that we could gather up, and then actually just spend some time praising the Lord. And I want to just challenge you, because this is a challenge to me this week. I think it's overdue for me, is just to find a time and spend some time in prayer and do absolutely nothing. Don't ask for anything. Don't seek for anything. Don't petition for anything in this prayer. You can, you know, there's plenty of time for that. But just spend some time exclusively praising the Lord for His blessing in my life. It's amazing what that'll do for your contentment. And it takes us back to this discipline of finding Him at work in our lives. True contentment is available to us. May God at least let us spread out the parameters of those times that we are. May God move us in a direction that we are content in Him.